presence of everyone today. Good to have you. Good to have Lance again. Lance sort of comes and goes. Kind of like my mind. Good to have Ryder back from school. Good to see him. Good to have Susie back, as was said. She has been under the weather. Good to have the Grahams with us today. And David Hornbrook, he has to go to work, I think, at noon. But he'll be with us this worship period and was here in Bible class. Good to have him again. Someone asked me a while ago what I was preaching on. I don't know why you all do that exactly. I know Neil used to do that all the time. Wanted just, a pre-announcement or something or other. Know what to expect or anticipate, or if it sounded like it would be worthwhile, or I don't know. But anyway, I told Lloyd a while ago I was going to talk about rivalries between brothers and sisters. And boy, he got excited about that. He seemed like he was really engaged on that topic. The title is Old Rivalries Between Brothers and Sisters. That's the, you could have it extended to make it clear. Rivalries between brothers and brothers. Between sisters and sisters, between brothers and sisters. I just have it brothers and sisters. It covers everything that I want to talk about this morning. As you think about your childhood, you look back on it, I just have to smile when I think. And I do it a lot. I just, for some reason, my mind drifts back a lot to my youth. And I just had such a fun time. I just smile about it when I think about the various things that were done. The feelings that I had at the time. The way life seemed to be. And it was, even though we all, you know, we had family problems like everybody does. But just looking back in a summary sort of way, it was just such an enjoyable time of life. And yet I can on occasion think about how, you know, my brothers and I, we might have gotten into it over something or other. Might have fussed a little bit, or I remember on one occasion my brother got a nosebleed out of a scuffle that occurred. And so I understand between brothers and brothers and brothers and sisters and sisters and sisters, just as the normal ongoing of life as you're growing up and learning and trying to find your place and trying to solidify all of your rights in the family, you know, your position and property, sometimes tensions arise over things, and it's an interesting development as it comes to pass. Some of these are very, in fact, just about all of these are very, very familiar to you. You've probably not had them lined up like this before, but I want us to think about some lessons we can learn from looking at the tensions that develop between siblings that you read about in the Scriptures. See if we can learn a lesson or two. Of course, the first case goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 4 with Cain and Abel. And this came up this morning, and John will talk about that a little bit in 1 John chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. We're just not quite down there yet. But we're warned with regard to being like Cain was. Cain and Abel. Cain was born and Abel was born, and there you've got these brothers down there, and so much time has passed, you're not informed as to how they got along during their growing up period, but at the age of responsibility, when they're told how to worship God, well, that suited and satisfied Abel, just like it does a lot of people, but most people are like Cain. And they didn't like the way that God prescribed worship. They wanted to do it another way. And so that was his problem. We're not told as to what all in his life had contributed to that kind of disposition. We're not told all that. Don't have to know all of that. You know, I can't just sit down and just analyze every little feature that has contributed to a disposition I arrived at a certain moment in my life. Though there might be a myriad of things that contributed to it. And I don't have to just philosophically analyze everything like that to know that at a given moment I had a sorry attitude, rotten disposition, or that I was sweet-spirited. I loved my fellow man. I loved God. I loved righteousness. A lot of things can contribute to that in human personality, the development of it. But all we need to know from Genesis 4 is it got to the point where Cain, when God prescribed worship, didn't want to do it like that. The Hebrews writer, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 3 and 4, he'll talk about that. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. He did it by faith. You come back to chapter 4 of Genesis, Cain didn't do it by faith. He just launched out there and made an offering that he wanted to be acceptable. Just like a lot of people. Well, if I take the time to offer something to God, He ought to be pleased with it. Where did you learn that? Who told you that? Can you point to a passage in the Old and New Testament that teaches that? And yet a lot of people are like that very thing. They don't know what the Bible says, have no clue. But they have this notion in the back of their mind, if I will give something, surely the God of the universe will be most pleased. Well, this may be a revelation to a lot of people, but that's not so. And in the Bible, God has prescribed the way we live and the way we worship. That's all prescribed. It's not up to me to say, well, I would have thought He would have accepted this. And so when God rejected Cain's offering, He got into a bad mood. His spirits fell. His countenance fell. He wasn't happy. A lot of people aren't. And there are a lot of things that contribute to the stagnant condition of misery on the earth. And so he falls into this mood where Cain, what's the matter with you? God asks him, in effect. What's the problem? Why are your spirits so low? Why has your countenance fallen? That sort of thing. Well, at any rate, God chides him, corrects him. You know, if you do well, that's what you ought to do. If you're not going to listen to me and do the right thing, sin is couching at the door. You need to grow up and learn. You need to be satisfied with what I tell you. And not only did he not take the correction very well, then he escalates his violation. Now, does that sound like anybody you know? Humans who will not let God correct them. No, we're going to do it our way. And if anybody gets in the way, if the Bible gets in the way, just so what? And so I'll do another wrong thing. I'll make another wrong choice because I don't listen to God. I don't care what God says. I don't want to know. And so then he goes and he finds Abel at some point, finds him in the field, talks to him, and then kills him. And John will tell me in 1 John 3, though Moses doesn't do it, John tells me he specifically identifies the problem. He says, Cain killed Abel because Abel's works were righteous and his were evil. Now that doesn't sound like a very good motivation for a murder, does it? In fact, there is no good motivation for a murder. But of all the excuses that might be offered, how would that one look at judgment? I killed him, Lord. Why? Because he was good and I was bad. Now, most people will not fess up to that kind of an identification and description right now. But they're going to have to face it at judgment. Because the fight still goes on. The tension is still there between right and wrong in this world. And between righteous worship, acceptable, authorized, scripturally acceptable worship, and false worship, which God deplores. Most religion is full of false worship because most religions are false. Every religion but Christ is false. In the book of Revelation, you'll have reference to the false prophet. That's false religion. The beast, for a wrong government, imperial government gone crazy, even in the persecution of Christians. The beast, the false prophet, the prophets who prophesy falsely because they say things people want to hear. They advocate religions people want to practice. Not what God has said. They, just like Cain, want to go their own way. Offer what they want to offer. Develop dispositions that suits them. And when push comes to shove, get rid of any kind of thing that stirs memory of righteousness. I'll get rid of my brother. I'll take care of my problem. Get rid of my brother. How does that solve problems? Well, I don't have to see him. I don't have to be reminded. You've probably heard me say on occasion how that sometimes people do not like to see you or do not like the church because they're not looking at it from the viewpoint of an honest and good heart. And they don't like to be reminded of living the right way. Because they know presently they have no desire to do that. Now that's not like somebody that really does want to learn how to live the right way. But there are so many people that just have no intention. That is not their heart's pursuit or desire. And so they see you, they see salt, they see light, they see leaven. And they know how they're living. And they're just like Cain. I don't like the comparison. And so they disdain, they mock, they, or at least in their bedroom, they chide you, or they make excuses for not liking you. Well, why don't you like him? Oh, well, you know, he owns this, or he's got this, or he does this. And they make up some sort of a superficial excuse to cover over the real problem. They don't like you because you live right. And they're constantly reminded of the error of their way, and they don't like to have to face that. Why? Because they don't want to deal with it yet. And most of them will never deal with it, according to the Scripture. So, just like Isaiah 5 and verse 20, when God's people got to the point where they were calling evil good and called good evil. That's kind of the way Cain was looking at things, you know. Well, Abel has become the evil one in my eyes and I'm the good one. And so he commits murder. And you remember the questions in Acts 5, 3 and 5 that Peter asks Ananias? Why has Satan filled thy heart to lie to God? You know, to keep back part of the price. Why? Why? And then the second question is, how? How is it that you conceive this thing in thine heart? Now, there are two crucial points right there. First of all, you made your heart available to the devil. Why has Satan filled thy heart? Secondly, how hast thou conceived this thing? Remember James' description of temptation? Here's your heart, and you've got this desire for this bait. The devil's out there offering you this bait. And your heart is being pulled out there. You desire it. A conception takes place. The lust, when it hath conceived, beareth sin. And that's what you have in Acts 5. So I made my heart available, like Cain did. And then I can't just blame it on the devil completely. Lord, it's not me, it's the devil. And it's you and the devil. It was supposed to be you and me. And it's you and the devil. And you conceived this thing. So I can't just blame the devil for all my sins. He's certainly involved in every one of them. But I have to take responsibility for what I allowed him to do through me. Amazing. Well, there's still this antagonism between false and true worship, Cain and Abel. Number two, Jacob and Esau. Of course, an old rivalry that existed between those brothers. I tell you, it's something too, because in this, we have this great lesson of God's preference. As far as working out the scheme of redemption, God sees nations just like He sees individuals. He sees families just like He sees persons, an individual person. And before children are born, He knows what they're going to do, what they're going to think, what they're going to be like. That's all. It's the God of the Bible. It's the God of omniscience. It's the God who knows the beginning from the end. It's the God who calls things that are not before they are. And that's what He's doing with Jacob and Esau. And the New Testament writer, Paul, in Romans 9, talks about that. But back in the Old Testament, you know, Rebecca has these twins in her womb. And God explains to her that they're two nations. And she said, well, I thought that was a problem. He says that these are the heads of nations. And he takes a moment to explain to her that the elder is going to serve the younger. That's all fixed in God's providential program of the scheme of redemption. Before either boy saw the light of birth, it was all fixed in the mind of God. And so God's preference for Jacob over Esau, well, it had to do, it seems, with the way that the boys were going to develop their character. Now, Jacob, refers to a supplanter. You remember that when Esau was born, and he came out in appearance red, and he had a lot of hair on him already at birth. And Jacob comes out as a smooth-skinned little fella. But when Esau was born, he comes out, and somewhere in the arrangement, Jacob is seen to be holding his heel. Strange, isn't it? This looks like just an accident. It just looks like a casual moment. And why do you even have reference to that? Well, it has to do with a supplanter, a heel catcher. That's his name. A heel catcher, a supplanter. Somebody who trips someone, as it were. And so, it's already indicated by God that the elder is going to serve the younger. And then you have this unusual, and just looks like a normal deal, but for some reason, this baby's got a hand on the heel of his brother. Amazing in a way. And then as the boys grow, you know, they're different in their personalities. And Esau is favored by his father, Isaac, and Jacob is favored by his mother, Rebekah. But we're explained in Romans 9, verses 10 through 13, that before the boys were born, that God already had chosen Jacob over Esau. Esau, I hate it. There's a word there. You have to look it up to see what it means. And it doesn't mean that God is just violently opposed to him. But Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. And it simply indicates a preference. It's the same word that's used with regard to Rachel and Leah, when her husband loved her and hated her. Doesn't mean he despised her. He just preferred this woman. The preference. And so, in this discussion of Jacob and Esau, we have the fact that God has the right and the foresight to make use of persons that will serve Him the way that His plan needs to be served. And so, while Jacob, his heel catcher, and by the way, we do see later that he becomes involved, gets involved in the deception of getting the blessing. And he talked his brother out of his birthright. There was no deception there. His brother was just, he just despised his birthright. And the Hebrews writer in chapter 12 refers to Esau as profane. Someone who is, it can be translated unholy. It can be translated as someone who despises something. And that's what he did with his birthright. He didn't show any sense. He didn't show any judgment. And he turned his back on his birthright by soup. I'll take the soup. I need food right now. That thing's only good later. How many times have you heard me say, keep the long-range view in mind? Not the short-sighted one. Keep the long-range view in mind. And then later, Jacob was involved with his mother in deceiving him. But God knew how he would grow and into what character he would become, just as he knew what Esau was all about. So there developed, of course, this great hostility between the two brothers. And later, before they died, they patched things up. I'm glad they got everything patched up. And by the way, God blessed Esau with an abundance of goods on this earth when they finally got together. You know, Jacob would say, oh, take these things from me. Take these. No, God's been good to me. He's blessed me with this and this and this. God watched out for the two nations. There was hostility on occasion. There were problems. But the two brothers patched things up before they passed away. Israel, Jacob's name later given to him by God, indicates how God knew he would develop. How did you start off? As a scoundrel? Did you start off with very little sense, very little respect? God knows every heart, its developmental stages, what it's going to be, and what the heart at rock bottom is. God knows all of that. And when He named him Israel, He gave him that name because it signified what Jacob had become. And it means having power with God. Having power with God. So the heel catcher, the tripper, the supplanter, becomes someone who has power with God. Did he change somewhat? Did he become something useful and better than he heretofore had been? Maybe there's hope for me. Number three, Leah and Rachel are two sisters. And I guess most of the time they had gotten along. But there develops a situation in which there were some problems, some tension. Genesis 29:31, Genesis chapter 30, you'll see it. And this has to do, of course, in the age of multiple marriages. Multiple marriages. It wasn't what God wanted, either Gentilism or Judaism, but God allowed that. Polygamy. And you remember that Jacob was working for his uncle, and he worked a while so that he could marry Rachel. And lo and behold, when it finally came time to have Rachel, the customs of the age, kept her covered up pretty much, even on, I guess you'd say, the wedding night, or whatever. And he didn't know who he was getting. Well, what customs of dress? My goodness, I'm still in the dark here. And he didn't know it, but finally he did. Laban, I did not work those years for this woman. I wanted that one. Well, in our society here, it is customary that the oldest girl marry first, and you chose one that wasn't the oldest. So, it'll be okay, son. It'll be okay. Just, work a few more years and I'll let you have this one. Laban was all heart. Work a few more years and I'll let you have this. And in the meantime, of course, Jacob has Leah. And it's not that he's just so much opposed to Leah, but it's not what he had in mind. It wasn't what he wanted. And that's the sense in which he loved Rachel, but he hated Leah. He preferred her. And she was barren. God had made it impossible for her to have children. And when God saw what Jacob was doing, then he made it possible for her to have children. Because he had compassion on her in her tension. It was like she was a rival with her sister, And she knew that her husband favored her sister. See, that's the kind of thing you get into in multiple marriages. It's not ideal. It's rife with problems. We see other kinds of problems in the New Testament because of those kinds of situations. So here we've got jealousy over a husband's affection. Not a very good kind of situation, is it? And she'll have a child and she'll say, "Now my husband will prefer me." It won't work. Then she'll have another child. "Now he'll be turned toward me." It doesn't work. Never does. But that was always her hope, of trying to come up in his affections to where her sister already was. Not a very good way to have to live, is it? And anyway, you bear your burden. You live in those kinds of situations. But it has to do with the affection. I know that affections can change to a degree. Titus 2 and verse 4 in your New Testament, you older women, you train the younger women to love their husbands and love their children. And that's the word for affection. And especially does that become insightful in cultures where somebody else is picking out your mate for you. I've talked to you about that. In America, from early on, we start looking at girls and boys. I think that would make a good husband. She'd make a good wife. I sure like the way he looks or she looks. And the personality and all that. My, and I would select and select and select. But a lot of people grew up where they didn't select at all. And so they wind up, just like Jacob, with a woman he didn't want. And somebody else picking for you, so that from early on it's already decided, and you have no affection at all. Well, you can learn to have some. I think there might be a limit to that. I really don't see how Just like in Leah's case. It has to stop at a certain point. But if you just can't stand your kids, and you can't stand your wife, you know, there's a way, the Bible says, you can learn to do better. But it's a matter of taking on personal responsibility. It's a matter of growing up and bearing the load that you must bear. Now, a lot of Americans aren't like that. Mm-mm. At the sound or the sight of the least tension, problem, thing I don't like, I just don't like it. I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. I'm not going to live with it. That's the way Americans do. We throw things away like we throw garbage away. If I didn't choose it, if I didn't want it, then no, sir, never. A lot of people lived in cultures where the affectionate change was a matter of adaptation and maturing. Maybe it can only go so high, but it better go there. It better go there in order for things to work out like God wanted them to. At any rate, jealousy. Jealousy over a husband. Later on, by the way, in the law of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 21, there was a law that God had written down in because of this very kind of situation where you had a woman preferred over another one in these polygamous marriages. And he said, the right of the firstborn goes to the firstborn child. I don't care if it's the woman that was not preferred. You husbands, you cannot pass over the firstborn and get to the firstborn of the preferred woman. You favor the rights of the firstborn because he or she is the firstborn. A law came into place to control that kind of a situation as a matter of inheritance, of the estate, because of the way that we do. Number four. Got one more point and I'll stop here. Joseph and his brothers, of course, in Genesis 37 and following chapters, is very crucial too. And in this case, just as in the case with Esther, this is has to do with God's preference as to how He's going to save His people in a certain crisis moment in history. Joseph, of course, was the son of Jacob and of his favored wife, Rachel. He had a full brother, Benjamin. And all of the other brothers and sisters, you know, they were half brothers or sisters. But here he's got a full brother, Benjamin. And Joseph was such a keen person, and a person with a good heart, and a person of skill and understanding, it seems, and a person who respected his father and loved his family and all of that, and had no idea when he was growing up what his destiny was and whereunto this thing would grow and how God was going to use him. He couldn't see any of that. And it no doubt was a puzzle to him how that God was going to choose him over his brothers to save the whole family. And then to save the world through Christ. He knew none of that. But he grew up on the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. The God of Moses. The God of Abraham. The God of creation. He was brought up right. But he didn't know what all God had in mind. He would have these strange dreams. And Joseph had compulsion to relate them. The dreams indicated his eventual superiority over his brothers, and one of them even over his father. And when he would tell his brothers those dreams, they just despised him more and more. They already didn't like him because they knew the father favored him. And his father made him that special coat. And he just dotes on that boy. And those other boys out there, they just hated that. And then when he would relate these dreams that signified an eventual superiority over the family, oh, the dreamer. You know, they would downplay it. Jacob rebuked him one time, at least for telling it. But he thought about it. He kept it in his mind. The brothers just despised it completely. And so when Jacob sends him to check on his brothers one day, and he finally finds them at Dothan, and they see him coming, here comes the dreamer! Let's kill him. Now they wouldn't have done that back there at the father's house in the tent. They wouldn't have done that at all. We're a long way from home. It's just him and us. Let's once and for all get out of our misery and let's kill him. And Reuben stops that. However, they sell him. He winds up in Egypt. And finally, as you know, passing over a lot of very interesting facts, he gets to be ruler of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. And then later, when his brothers come down for food, because of the famine, he hides his identity and treats them very harshly, testing their character to see if they're the same ungodly men who sold him into slavery years ago. They don't know him. He knows them. He asks them about their family and all of that, and he makes specific inquiry. And at any rate, as you know, the thing all works out, and finally he sends for the father, the rest of the family, and he saves them from starvation. So, in the story of Joseph, in this sibling rivalry that eventuated in hatred and then into slavery, God says, I've got a right to choose the people that will serve my will in bringing about the scheme of redemption. And Joseph is the man of the hour. Just like Jacob had been the man of the hour, or Isaac had been, as Abraham was, and as others would be, like Noah and Daniel and Job, in their own way, in their own right, in their own place, in their own time. And finally, it's going to be John. And then it's going to be Jesus. And then it becomes the church and the providence of God working and willing in the lives of faithful brethren. Amazing. Amazing. Well, I've run out of time. But it's amazing how many old rivalries between brothers and sisters have actually contributed to God's overall theme of redemption and the management of history in order to get things done to His glory and to our eternal good. If you're here this morning and not a Christian, come in faith, John 8:24. Repent of your sins, Luke 13:3. Make the good confession with your mouth, Romans 10:9 and 10. Be baptized of water and spirit, John 3:3-5. You'll be a Christian, just a Christian. If you've done that and gone astray, it's a good time to come back. We encourage you to do it. While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?